welcome back to the Lumiere's podcast. My name is Jody, and this is episode 12. If you've never listened to this show before and you're new, welcome aboard. Thank you for listening. And maybe you're wondering what goes on here. Well, I kind of started this podcast with the idea of sharing conversations with people who I found to be doing particularly good work in the world, things that need to be noticed perhaps, or things that need to be highlighted in my opinion. So through these conversations, my purpose is to sort of weave a thread to introduce you to a range of people who I feel are out there walking their talk. You know, they're people actively contributing to making our world a brighter and healthier place to be in. We have a variety of guests on the show, people who are well known, people who are not so well known, people who I feel should be well known, or people who just have a story or something to share that I feel could benefit from a bit of a wider exposure. So I'm taking a role of curator, where I'm introducing you to people who I feel are worth listening to and what they've got to say. And today is no different. I'm very pleased to be able to present to you a conversation with Mr. Carl H. Smith, who is the director of the Learning Technologies Research Centre, London's Ravensbourne University. And he's a very interesting man, a very busy man, and he very kindly made time for me to pop over with my gear and record a little chat with him. So Carl is the director of the Institute, as I mentioned, and principal research fellow, and he's primarily interested in emergent technologies and how we can better harness them to create a more connected world. He's interested in the humanistic aspects of technology and applying this so we can sort of adapt and evolve our perceptual senses of the world and how we understand our place in it as a human being. And it's fascinating work, I think, to be involved in. He's really on the cutting edge of where these technologies are going to be integrated with our day-to-day lives and testing out things and experimenting. And he's a fascinating man. So I do hope you enjoy this conversation with Carl Smith. There's plenty of talks with him online, and I'll put a few of the links up at the website for you to check out. If you enjoy the conversation, you can support us by, go to my pages on Instagram and on Facebook. It's at Life in Fractals. That's me. That's where you can find everything that I'm up to, including this podcast. At the moment, this comes to you absolutely free, no charges. That may change in the future if we move to a donation model, but right now, this just comes to you for free and you can enjoy it. And all I ask is maybe that you share it or pass it on to a friend. That would be most appreciated. And I always like to play a song before we go into the conversation. I'm a big music fan and it's a massive part of my life. So it always feels nice to me to share some music that's kind of inspired me or inspired our guests or has a connection to the theme of the show. And in the conversation with Carl, he was talking about Ghost in the Shell. It's quite a famous Japanese anime that was recently remade with Scarlett Johansson into a live action film. And there's all sorts of augmented reality, human sort of nanotechnology, bioengineering, fusion stuff going on in that movie. And I thought it'd be an interesting sort of angle to go down. So I thought about Japanese musicians and people who I've really been touched by over the years, and the guy who sprung to mind was Susumu Yokota, who's kind of a veteran of the Japanese electronic scene, been around for a long time, many albums. And there's a particular track that I think I first heard when I was introduced to him. It was years ago now, but it's from his seminal record called Sakura, which I think is on the Leaf label. You can just Google that and find out. But this is a track from that record. It's called Tobayum, after which we'll go straight into a conversation with Carl H. Smith on the technologies that are currently being researched by him and his foundation, perceptual evolution, augmented reality, and the future of technology. Enjoy. Thank you. your de facto job title is Director of Learning Technologies Research Institute.
Yeah, LTRC, Learning Technology Research Centre at Ravensbourne. Yeah, Principal Research Fellow there. I've been there for about 3 years and moved my institution from London Metropolitan, where I was for 10 years at the Learning Technology Research Institute. So now it's LTRC rather than LTRI.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So what does a kind of typical day look like for you and what you're doing there at the moment?
Typical day, lots of varied projects, all technology enhanced learning. So looking at how people use technology, how technology is designed to improve whatever it is they're trying to improve. So it can be any subject, any technology. So we're basically looking at the moment we're really interested in what comes after VR and AR and moving into things like sensory augmentation, perceptual adaption.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
So, yeah, I saw in your Breaking Convention, the most recent talk that you did, you were talking about the way you could hack like things like what the lady who talks about empathy engines, or is it empathy machines, and she's like feeling the earthquakes.
That's right, yeah, that's Moon Rebus. She's part of Cyborg Nest, and we're working with them on their new sense. So they're both Moon Rebus and Neil Harbison have got very bespoke prosthetic devices that give them specific abilities. I think the origin of it was Neil Harbison, where he is completely colorblind, and he's got a prosthetic device that attaches to his skull. So he's using bone conduction to convert light wave into sound wave.
Bone conduction, what does that mean?
Good question. I've not actually looked into how the real science behind it, but he had various iterations of the prosthetic device, and he's actually considered the world's first cyborg because his passport photo has this prosthetic device in, and he's quite a funny guy, and he said a lot of different people try and rip it off. People think that they're, you know, being filmed, but actually he's just converting, you know, light into sound, so he can hear. He's completely colorblind, so he's trying to actually hear all these different all these different light waves, and he can actually hear into the ultraviolet, you know, so he can tell when it's too dangerous to go outside in terms of the sunshine's too bright, so he'll know it's too dangerous. But yeah, Moon Rebus is interesting because she's got a prosthetic device that enables her to feel any earthquake in the world. So it's like a seismic sense that she's got, and again, she does performances where she will, if there's an earthquake in the world, she will move, but otherwise she will stay completely stationary for the hour or whatever length of the performance is.
And is this something that is she using this as a creative tool, or is it for her art, for her performances, or is she kind of using this on an evolutionary level to explore, you know, like how she relates to the earth or
yeah, something? I think she experiences the earth in a way that no one else does. So she, you know, she's created an empathy engine to have that, the relationship with Earth that we don't have. You know, the other project, the North Sense project, is really interesting, and that's the sort of the first sense that they've released officially. And it's interesting talking to the co-founders of that, Scott and Liviu, because Liviu, recently we were interviewed for the new Morgan Spurlock film, which is all about intelligence amplification.
Okay.
And it is very interesting that, what people keep saying to me, what is it going to give us, you know, what does this North Sense give us? And I'm, you know, we're doing the research, so 300 people are turning this new sense on at the moment. And we're doing quite a longitudinal study with those group of people to actually see, you know, what does it mean when you maybe have lost a sense due to technology, and then we give it back to you through technology. So it's kind of like, can we use technology to undo the damage of previous iterations of technology? Because, you know, if we did have a North Sense, like a lot of birds do, we probably lost it through, you know, the construction of maps, etc. And obviously there's a big problem with people being addicted to GPS and not actually, you know, having a sense of where they are in the world, or certainly not
for sure,
relying on their own abilities. So, you know, it's what's particularly fascinating is that the compass wasn't invented for navigation. It was actually invented for divination and feng shui. Mm. And the Chinese 2,000 years ago invented that device and didn't appropriate it or, you know, for a navigation tool for another 1,000 years. So for 1,000 years, it was used to decide where they would place their cities in their massive country and where they would then place buildings within those cities. So, you know, we're really interested in what new abilities will people get. You know, I'm really interested in this whole idea of, you know, we have blood coursing around our veins and the blood has iron in it, which is magnetic. So there's definitely something in the position of yourself in space. And I think that technologies now are bringing us back into the world, kicking and screaming a lot of the time. But I think if you look at things like Pokemon Go, you know, not the best sort of content, but at least people are out in the world again. And I'm really interested in, we're kind of interested in gamifying the North Sense users to make them go into areas where there is a known, you know, magnetico reception issue, and to report back what they find and to see if there's any gender differences, whether there's age differences, whether there's cultural differences, because there's, I think, 23 countries involved.
Yeah, I was just going to say, are they spread across the world?
Yeah. There's a large proportion in different countries. And, you know, just as a simple experiment for the Morgan Spurlock film, we took a North Sense user and a non-North Sense user, and we took them into a large room. We told them that the task was just to walk across to the other side of the room. And then we blindfolded them, we disorientated them, so I spanned them around multiple times in multiple directions. And then they were to go off to the other side of the room. And then we would stop them on that side and then spin them around again, and their task was simply to point back to where they came from. And the difference between the North Sense user and the non-North Sense user was quite amazing. And it was it wasn't a planned or a serious research experiment, but it was something that really made you realise that actually this may be very useful for both putting us back in the world and also giving us that sense of spatial literacy that we've long lost.
So am I right in thinking that it vibrates when they are facing north or something similar?
That's right, yeah. Very sort of quick. It doesn't constantly vibrate while you're facing north. It just vibrates subliminally, you know, that one time for a short period.
So while they'd be spun around, they'd be getting...
Yeah. And what was interesting is that the mic was actually placed on his chest and it could hear them at the North Sense as the experiment was taking place. So that was a bonus.
So, I mean, you mentioned there about kind of technology when people are... There seems to be a bit of a divergence. And to me, I've got groups of friends who are really into, you know, the emerging technologies and the way that we can use technology to further, you know, humanity for the better, versus the group of people who are kind of like going back to the Stone Age and looking at like primitive technologies and wanting to survive outside without anything, without food and water and that kind of stuff, and having those experiences. Like, where do you see a coming together of that kind of thing, or do you think there's a ton of divergent paths?
I think it's a big design problem, isn't it? Technology's always been a big design problem, and it's arguably much more of a design problem now because the technology is coming so thick and fast, and the pedagogy to keep up with the technological advances can't keep up, basically. So it keeps me very busy because of these new interventions. But from my perspective, from my research team's perspective, we're really interested in, you know, using the body again as a technology and being aware of all of the abilities that the body has. Whenever I look at a digital skill or a digital intervention, I always look at what is the analog version of it. You know, and I keep a big track of that kind of thing, because I think I would never use technology just for technology's sake. So I'm much more of a human centric rather than techno centric.
That seems to be a bit of a key piece.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise you kind of get off down this sort of detached wormhole of, disembodied.
Yes, yes. Mm. And there's so little in terms of regard for human perception or human abilities to plug into the technology. A good example of that is VR, where it's fundamentally broken, you know, because the tech companies didn't bring in vision experts into the drawing room when they were putting these things together. And it's a great example of that technocentric point of view. Let's just get the thing out there without worrying about nausea. And I think that's a critical problem because, you know, if we look at how VR actually works, you know, everything's just placed at a fixed distance. There's, you know, there's no depth in what you're looking at. And, it's definitely fixable, but we have to look back to the vision lessons from sort of the 1880s. Mm. So what you're seeing now is all the tech companies hunting down these vision scientists because they know that VR's dead in the water without, you know, because you just can't wear it. And one of the projects we're working on with Mark Farid is the Seeing Eye project, where he wants to wear the Oculus or an equivalent for 28 days and look through somebody else's eyes, so he won't have access to his own eyes or his own hearing for for a whole month. And he's chosen a month because that's how long it takes to form habits. But the problem is if you look at the guidelines for the Oculus, their guideline is you should only wear the device for an hour. So, you know,
wow.
Maximum an hour. So if, he's actually looking to us to get ethics clearance for his project, and we just told him, no way. unless we actually make a modified VR headset for him, which is actually the plan, because we've got this other project called Natural Media, where we're actually looking to fix VR as close as possible to actually be to fit human vision. So when you look in VR, you actually, you're as close as to how you would actually see as possible. Mm. That's a massive project, and obviously a key one for this sort of idea of building everything around human perception. Because, you know, if you look at what happens to the brain when it sits in VR for any length of time, it's not looking good.
Okay.
So ultimately, you know, we're actually combining the Seeing Eye project with this Natural Media idea, where we're actually looking to improve things like medical diagnostics, telemedicine, where surgeons are actually looking through VR headsets onto a body. The problem with traditional cameras and traditional image making is that it's all based on linear perspective, and linear perspective is actually the oldest technology we have. Mm. 500 plus years old. But the problem with linear perspective is it shuts off the whole peripheral of what you're seeing. So you get like a 40 degree shutdown where you're losing most of the peripheral vision on what you're seeing. And then that is compounded by the fact that we are then looking at those images on mobile devices, which, you know, these tiny screens again eliminate the peripheral vision. So, you know, how do we, the mobile phones are, don't even get me started on the zombification of the world through these terrible interface. But I truly believe this is a stepping stone, and it's just one step along the way of what we need to do in terms of how we interact with the world. And, you know, the problems caused by linear perspective are so widespread and so endemic that we really need to address them, and we need to work with guys like that we're working with Fovography, which is an alternative traditional photography, where we can actually bring that peripheral vision back in. And we're really, you know, I'm really fascinated by, I went into a full dome the other day and watched a 360 film.
Mm.
And that was fascinating because it's almost like an antidote to the mobile phone, because by definition you're using your peripheral vision. And just sitting there for 20 minutes watching this experience, and I know from researching peripheral vision exercises that a lot of athletes, for instance, will, before a big race, they will, you know, stare into their peripheral vision, and they will defocus from the usual. What we always do is just focus in front of us and then try and take in the whole image. And what it does is seemingly it seems to calm down your whole physiology. So again, before a big talk, I'll do the peripheral vision exercise. It only takes a minute, and there's a definite effect. So,
are you talking about kind of like the up, down, left, and right, kind of to the extremities and
rest? Just literally, I mean, you can practice now just by just defocus from the center and actually just taking the whole image at once, and just stay in that state as long as you can. So I'm really interested in what technologies can we adopt, can we use to bring back that skill and that ability and that benefit.
I mean, there's parallels it makes me think of, there's an exercise in one of the Carlos Castaneda books where he's talking about sitting with non-focused vision, where you just sit and take in, and it's a kind of like a meditation.
Yeah.
The idea is to kind of see everything and nothing. So you're sort of not focused on any one particular thing, but you're just being aware of everything in the picture, from the edges to the center, and you're trying to just take it all in and witness it. And that kind of thing is interesting. And the one that I got taught once was a bushcraft kind of technique. They used to call it owl vision. You just kind of like send your eyes to as high as kind of up as far as you can, down as far as you can, left and right as far as you can, and you just repeat that and you hold it at each point.
Yeah.
And after a while, it kind of like, when you come back to just not out of the practice, your vision's changed. Like the way that you're perceiving things includes the periphery.
Yeah.
A little more.
That's fascinating, because I've just actually been at Birkbeck all day, where we're working on the second phase of a big Wellcome Trust bid. And we're looking at, this whole question, because, a lot of, say keyhole surgery, as a laparoscopy, as an example, if you're capturing the body, if you're actually capturing something and trying to look at it, a surgeon's trying to look at it as if they're actually seeing it without it being inside the body, you're dependent on a camera, which is based on linear perspective. So, in terms of, let's say, an 8-hour operation, we're very used to seeing images, and our brain does that translation between how we normally see and how this image is being constructed. But if you're doing an 8-hour operation and you're constantly having to use your brain to do this translation, then you're going to get eye strain, and it's a known problem. So we think that there's a lot that natural media can be used there to actually fix that problem.
So it seems like what you're doing is like on the most cutting edge that's possible to be, really, like with this kind of stuff. It's conceptualizing and then developing from the concepts and then testing it out. And it's like, do you feel like you're developing future technologies, or do you feel more of a kind of experimenter with perception?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, I'm definitely, learning much more about perception and the effect that, the idea that we think we stop learning how to see at a certain age, and that age is very young, but actually we never stop learning how to see. And obviously vision is so primary in terms of our senses. And we're just at the forefront, and there's not enough, like I said, there's only just an awareness now becoming prevalent with the big tech companies hiring all these vision experts, because, there's so much to learn. And when we're building systems now, which will take the same content but change the perspective that you're seeing it in, and doing that in real time, which is what photography does, it's an amazing thing to, like you said, with your owl vision exercise. It's there's so much that we can experiment on. And I suppose I'm very conscious that we need to get this right, because VR they're already saying VR is again in crisis, because not enough people have bought headsets.
Still early days, though, surely.
It's not really. I mean,
really?
VR's been around a very, very long time. And
in terms of mainstream, though?
It's had many iterations. I mean, if you think, I know Mark Pesce, he's the inventor of VRML. But yeah, I just think that they've really missed a trick with the you know, with the headsets. And I think, you know, we still have, you know, we still have the opportunity to do something interesting with VR, because there's, you know, I tried the tree hugger experience the other night in Brighton, where you're, you know, you are moving around this tree, you know, and they've got this big sort of synthetic sort of tree trunk in the middle of the room, and it's a big redwood tree, and the point is that you're following the water as it comes, you know, from the ground, and it goes up the tree. So you have the ability to put your head inside the tree and see what's going on inside the tree and see how the water's being moved around the tree by the,
and it
really gave me hope for VR, because, you know, when you start to think about what we're saying about this empathy engineering, and, you know, how do we tune back into nature. I'm, you know, a big fan of Darren Stevenson, whose posts on Facebook are, you know, he talks about the idea that when you post a picture of a flower, a real flower dies. because of the amount of, you know,
yeah,
you know, the fact that how much energy a Google search has, etc. Mm. Everyone thinks the cloud is actually a cloud, whereas actually it's very hardcore environmental damaging infrastructure. So I suppose there's, you know, when you see a tree hugger experience like that, or you get to experience what it's like to be inside different animals' perception. You know, I'm really interested in this idea of the Umwelt, which is the idea that we all contextually have very different, in terms of different species, they all have different Umwelt. They have a different way of perceiving the world.
Mm.
And if we can actually use technology to experience these different Umwelts, then that technology justifies itself, because, you know, I think, you know, Darren would say, well, we can just interact with nature, and we can just interact and use our imaginations to experience this sort of stuff. But I think there is, you know, there's tons of examples where technology is being used to combat phobias or combat, you know, all sorts of different ailments that, you know, that basically will, you know, wouldn't be so easy, like post-traumatic stress syndrome, where people are able to re-experience some trauma, knowing that they're not, you know, knowing that they're not actually physically there, but actually able to, you know, replay stuff using VR as an aid. So I think VR is interesting because it enables you to go inside yourself, whereas the main work we're doing is in augmented reality, where you're much more in the world and you're overlaying the world with information. And I think that's much more of a goer in terms of, you know, because it doesn't have the same issues with nausea as VR does. Mm. So the big project we're working on with AR is the WeKit project, where we're looking at how do you create wearable experience as a new form of media. That's partly why I'm so fascinated in this area, because it's now possible to create entirely new forms of media, entirely new types of experience. And a simple example of what we're doing with the WeKit project is capturing expert experience using this. We're actually working with Microsoft on the HoloLens, which again isn't an ideal solution, but they're a couple of years ahead of everyone else in terms of AR. But what's fascinating is, yeah, we're able to capture an expert. We're working with astronauts, surgeons.
Wow.
Yeah, we're able to capture one of these experts doing a task. You know, we can capture an entire room, make a 3D model on the fly of everything that's going on. Say in a surgery, we can map the everything that's going on with the body, and then we can also map the surgeon's head movement, his eye movement, hand movement, finger movement, and then a novice surgeon with smart glasses and smart gloves can actually wear the expert, so they can actually be in the body of the expert. They can see ghost hands of where the expert's moved.
Whoa, that's mind-blowing.
That, yeah.
The applications of that as well.
Yeah. So I suppose, you know, a lot of people would say, well, that's, you know, there's the whole automation debate. But for me, I think, you know, even if I look at my masseuse, my amazing Thai masseuse, who claims that she can't get a massage because the skills aren't there, all the skills are dying. So if you can capture some, you know, some experience that is very rare, and allow, you know, a novice to actually benefit. Like, think about a tea ceremony. Like, that's one of my examples. Imagine how long it takes to learn how you do a tea ceremony. But if you're actually in the body of the expert, then, you know, arguably you're going to learn a lot quicker.
That's a fascinating area, I think, like recording people's actual skill sets almost and then making it transferable to somebody in the future. That's, yeah, these are, you know, these are just kind of things that would have seemed just, you know, just like a dream, really, even a few years ago. It just sounds like such a futuristic, imaginative thing, and it's now becoming a concrete reality. Yeah. What about applications for, because I've heard about things like, you know, microdose VR, where they're doing like painting inside VR, and the brushes are animated and they're themselves spawning animations all in real time in that space. So do you see any kind of applications for creativity with the kind of AR space?
Yeah, massively. You know, I think that the potential for art, you know, developing new art forms in these spaces has only just begun. You know, if you think of Paint, the old Paint program on Microsoft, that's coming to the HoloLens.
Oh, really?
So you'll be able to paint in 3D space, but not in Tilt Brush. You know, the Google's Tilt Brush, that's in VR, but this is in AR. So you'll actually be able to, you know, have virtual exhibitions, well, augmented exhibitions, where you've actually done whatever you want in the actual space that you're in, and painting over people, etc. But for me, it's like, I can see a scenario where, you know, somebody put the Simpsons filter on my vision the other day, where I was, you know, actually I think it was an HTC Vive or something that had the pass-through camera. So pass-through camera enables you to turn any VR headset into an AR headset, because you can literally just turn on the camera on your mobile phone, and then you're able to use that as your eyes.
And this wasn't intended by the people who made the...
No, this was a little demo, and I didn't realise it was live. So I moved my head to the right, and then I realised it was a real demo, and actually the Simpsons was everywhere. You know, it was like I looked at people and they were all in Simpsons colours. And it made me realise that ultimately, you know, in terms of, you know, we'll be deciding what we want to wear in terms of fashion, but then we'll also be deciding what, you know, what vision, what filter on our vision we would like. And you sort of imagine real time Photoshop, you know, where everything's but everything's going to be, you know, there'll be no common ground because everyone will have their own.
It's so individualized, like, at that point.
I think ugliness will become a really rare, you know, thing, because a lot of people will just have that Photoshop. I mean, even on my friend's phone, we've got all these different settings where you can have like a beauty setting. Like, so you take a photo and it's already got built-in Photoshop, you know, to actually like make you get rid of your wrinkles and stuff. And it strikes me that is the way it's going to go. And, you know, you'll be able to delete things like men. If you don't like men, you'll just be able to delete them, because your glasses will be, you know, they'll be mapping everything in front of you in 3D. So you won't be taking photos in 2D. You'll be making 3D models of everything. You know, you're already seeing it now with modern mobile phones that can literally just take a scan of the space. And if you've got a 3D model of the space, then you can actually place anything in that space. So.
What do you think about the kind of like combination of things, like, I suppose you could call psychedelics a technology in a way of perception, What about the combination? Because there's people exploring this, isn't there? The combination of kind of changing your perception and then changing your perception through AR or VR on top of that.
Yeah.
Is there anything that, what do you kind of have any thoughts about that kind of stuff?
Yeah, basically I think the whole moist media work that Roy Ascott came up with many, many moons ago, he talked about exactly that, you know, taking ayahuasca and then going into VR.
So people have done this, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the point, you know, that we're such at a crossroads where people will be able to, you know, combine whatever medicines they're, or plant medicines that they're interested in with VR. And I can imagine VR experiences. I mean, I've been involved at the Imperial with the DMT study, so they're looking at what happens to the brain when you take intravenous DMT. And one of our fellow participants in the study wants to sort of reverse engineer the DMT visuals in VR. And I'm like, well, for me, that's a bit of a non-starter because, you know, it's not just the visuals when you're in that space. It's you know, the body load and the whole effect on your world view. But yeah, I think that you will start to see specific experiences designed for certain psychedelics or, you know, certain types of, you know, I'm really interested in, you know, things like holotropic breathwork as an analog version of LSD. So yeah, I can imagine, you know, you're already seeing it with things like the Pandora star or the Lucia light, where you're able to supposedly trigger endogenous DMT by staring into this white light in front of you. So, and that's now being combined with holotropic.
Do you think you could take that kind of thing into the dream state? So like, I've seen those, they had those early sort of lucidity trigger devices where you wear the goggles and then when you're in REM sleep, it sort of flashes a red light or something. And then that's your kind of lucidity awakening thing. I mean, could you take that further and sort of use these things within a dream state or like, do you know?
Yeah,
I
mean, there's lots of work going into the Persinger helmet. It was an early 60s sort of device that you would wear that would give you transcranial stimulation, and you know, you'd reliably have out of body experiences, or you'd reliably have that presence behind your body. But that also is being used whilst you're asleep. So as soon as you hit REM sleep, they again give you a small amount of transcranial stimulation and reliably produce lucid dream states. So I always joke that eventually we'll all have this lucid dream area to also do whatever we want in. So it'd be a new space that opens up. And I joke that I'll be scanning all the articles that I don't have time to read in reality, and then, you know, I'll have them all read by the time I wake up.
Oh god, there's so many possibilities. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
The other thing that I was gonna going back to what you're saying about am I right in thinking you were part of the LSD trials as well?
That's right, yeah.
So how did that, maybe we could talk about that for a minute if that's okay
with
you.
Sure.
How was the so you were one of the first legally administered subjects with LSD and DMT, I guess, in this country?
Yeah, that's correct.
Which is quite an honour.
It is an honour, yeah. I mean, I think when you look at the brain scans of people, of the people in that study, you know, it's, and you see the brain lit up like a Christmas tree. This is responsible for what's now being termed the psychedelic renaissance. And I'm a big fan of breaking convention, and have been since its inception. And you know, I think that in terms of the ecological crisis, we need an awakening of consciousness. And if you see all the people from the West heading out to do ayahuasca, there seems to be, you know, a real thirst for getting unity experiences very, very, very rapidly. But for me, I'm really interested in this idea of cyberdelics. So creating not necessarily mapping directly to a psychedelic experience. I don't think you can do that, but creating a whole new range of psychedelic effects through technology. We can create out-of-body experiences, whether it's things like the passenger helmet or just by putting you in a VR headset and linking it up to two cameras and then putting the cameras behind you. Because the brain's always asking, where am I, where am I? And using all the senses to try and establish that, your brain's super easily tricked. And, it won't be tricked for very long, but if you add another sense, if you trick it, add another modality into the tricking, then you can maintain that for a while. I think, we need to wake up. We need to wake up globally. And the more and the varied ways of doing that, the better. And this is why a lot of my work is looking at this idea of context engineering, and looking at all the different ways that we can create context. And what I mean by context is, we've done content to death. We've made a load of different types of content. We've got a massive resources problem. So let's look at how do we change our perception as the content and create tools that will enable us to do that. And I think there's a lot of thirst out there for this experience economy where, we're realizing that actually, we've consumed so much and we've all got this information glut. How do we fix it? I mean, things like I've worn a 360 helmet for a week. And it's crazy because it's, you take this 360 input, squash it into 180 degree visor, and your brain only takes 15 minutes to adjust to seeing that new reality. And it's almost as if the brain goes, well, why didn't you do this before? Because there is seemingly no nausea and no problem with that. So for me, we need a new science around all these different ways of augmenting perception, different ways of achieving sensory augmentation, mixing the senses we already have, like the aroma fork, which actually mixes smell with taste, and creates a whole new range of experiences, or the Nirvana headset, which stimulates the vagus nerve as you're listening to music.
Now that sounds great.
Yeah.
I want to try that.
Yeah, because it's, it's a piece of hardware that has the potential to transform the whole medium of music. And I think that's really exciting. And, all the Luddites out there will say, no, we should only use our own natural abilities. But, what is nature? I mean, the fact that we've created technology, I mean, for me, it's all part of nature. It's just that we need to design it around known perceptual issues.
I guess the question that I keep coming back to with all this is like, well, we know that there's a resource crisis going on the planet, and we've got a finite amount of resources, and a lot of these devices, a lot of the materials are finite.
Yeah.
So it almost seems to me like there's a race against time to try and either create new ways of creating, I don't know, maybe we kind of create these molecules rather than mine them, or, is there going to be a point where we just run out of time and or are the technologies going to be developing faster and faster and faster, and so that we can, when we reach that point, there's a fix?
Yeah. I mean, I think, I'm really interested in the whole, recycling technologies and, not upgrading your mobile every 6 months. I think that's a dead end, and I think a lot of people are realizing that. I've just bought the new MacBook Pro from work, and a lot of people saying, well, it's a backward step rather than a forward step. So I think it's all about educating yourself and actually choosing your technology wisely, and also and having a literacy around when you should be using technology. I mean, a lot of my friends won't use the internet to answer questions that they've got until they've exhausted every other avenue for answering that question, and seeing it as sort of a global brain not to be constantly used, in the same way not to constantly use GPS, because you lose your natural abilities.
But that's going to take like a certain degree of self-discipline that not everyone has, and especially in this kind of age of everything's so accessible and so instant, it's almost seductive to be able to have that at the touch of your fingertips. And like,
It creates Wally World, doesn't it?
Mm.
You know, that whole, you know, everything at your fingertips and not needing to move. You know, I know from research that there's a massive relationship between movement and cognition. Mm. And if we're all stationary Wally World participants, not, you know, not moving, not like thinking for ourselves, you're right, it takes discipline, but ultimately, you know, you get to a certain point and you just feel overwhelmed.
Yeah. Yeah. Where you just need that kind of distance, I guess, from it. Mm.
Yeah.
So what's your, I mean, if any, do you have a vision of where this is all going, say like 50, 100 years?
I think if you look at films like Ghost in the Shell from last year, where they're talking about, you know, what sensory augmentation have you got, you know, and that becoming a common theme, you know, and why I'm interested in the whole context engineering idea is because, you know, it's our birthright to be able to change our consciousness, and that's really being taken away from us in so many different areas. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, much like we choose TV programs now, we'll be choosing different types of sensory augmentation.
And not just sensory, do you think it'd be physical augmentation or the sort of Absolutely. Nanotechnology, cyborg Absolutely. Stuff that you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously, it's kind of arrogant and patronising to tell people how they should use technology.
Yeah.
And I'm very mindful of that, you know, that's why it's a very interesting area to look at, you know, how the North Sense is being adopted and how, you know, some people are piercing that, you know, the design of the product is to be, you know, body pierced into your chest, but some people are, you know, they're putting it on their arm or they're not piercing it at all, but using it like you might use a compass. So, you know, I think that it's incredibly difficult to prescribe how technology must be used, but I think we just need a literacy around the technologies and the benefits and the disadvantages of prolonged use of this particular device, and that's why we're creating this science of contextology, which is an exciting area. And I think that there's you know, there's tons of need for it, because without the literacy, you know, people don't know that all this is available to them, and that they're just stuck indoors watching EastEnders.
So do you see this sort of dripping down to the consumer level, you know, which is what is now conceptual and what is now just being kind of developed?
Well, if you look at any of my talks online, I'm always showing examples that are already here.
Okay.
You know, I'm very mindful of sort of DIY hacks.
Mm.
You know, if you look at when the Google Cardboard came out, it was hacked and then kickstarted. The improved version was kickstarted and, you know, that sold out. And it's kind of like, I think that's what we need. We've got to be very mindful of the fact that these big corporations don't necessarily have our well-being in mind when they're putting this stuff out there. So I think, you know, the fact that a lot of this stuff comes from the military or big corporations is that I show a lot of artists' hacks of those technologies in order to inspire people to not just, you know, be happy with what they're given, and actually show very practically how you can augment the stuff that's already there.
Mm-hmm. So the sort of things that you were talking about earlier, like the Pandora Star and these sort of like devices, are these things that people are able to access currently, or these sort of, they're quite rare experiences at present?
I think the Pandora Star is like the sort of much cheaper version of the Lucia light, but from speaking to Dirk and Engelbert, who run Lucia, they're making a much cheaper version as well. And yeah, when you're combining, say, the Lucia with holotropic breathwork, you know, it does lead to profoundly incredible altered states, you know, and then the visuals are very similar to sort of DMT visuals. So there's definitely something in it, and I know they're you know, looking at the science of it now. Mm. So yeah, I think these sorts of experiences, you know, the tree hugger experience that I mentioned, again, a lot of people haven't had that experience at the moment because, you know, it's not widely available. But I think, you know, when, you know, they say that VR will need to be saved by the arcade, you know, because people aren't buying the headsets because they haven't had the experience of being in a decent VR experience. So that's the point. So you go to the arcade to have your experiences, then you decide, you know, which device you're interested in. But yeah, it's an issue because, you know, there's a lot of people developing in VR. There's a massive bandwagon, and there's a lot of people talking a lot of rubbish about VR and AR, because people think it's the next big thing. But without fixing the fundamental problems that I've discussed, it's going to be a big, you know, a big sort of white elephant.
So what kind of areas outside of technology inspire you at the moment? What are you most inspired by to keep doing what you're doing, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I'm really interested in looking back. For me, it's about, you know, what ancient technologies and pedagogies exist out there that are important for how we drive the technology that we've got access to now. So I always talk about this idea of the memory palace, where, you know, you have... sort of 2,000 years ago, you had the Greek and Roman orators not writing anything down, but having these memory palaces, these virtual pieces of architecture in their heads that they would then map their seven-hour speeches to, you know, different parts of the structure they would map their speeches into. And then they would just need to remember the pathway through that structure in order to trigger the whole seven-hour speech. And that strikes me as a nice... way of framing AR, because AR is again about marking space with information. So can we use such ancient methodologies to actually really drive what we're trying to do now? You know, and thinking about the North Sense, you know, the idea that the Aboriginals, you know, they wouldn't say how are you. They would say, where are you coming from and where are you going? You know, and having that sort of sense of where you are in space again is, for me, a really interesting way of getting us, snapping us out of this, you know, because people say, how are you? And they give you this, I'm fine. And it's meaningless. Yeah. And actually that, for me, is a massive problem, because we're all just, you know, we're stuck in that mind frame. So, you know, what will the North Sense bring? I mean, this idea that, you know, this is an objective sense. You know, all the other senses you have are of subjective. But what would this sort of objective sense do? And it's fascinating hearing some of the stories coming out of the research. You know, the fact that this thing works on the underground, it works while you're in a plane. You know, you're encoding your direction in space, your location in space, with all of your other parameters.
And what's the duration of the study that you're doing with this?
We're doing an initial study with the, you know, about 10% of the users, in terms of doing in-depth interviews, looking at their motivations for getting the North Sense, looking at their expectations. And the next phase of the research is going to be building a mobile app, like I mentioned, so that we can gamify it and use that methodology to actually capture a lot more data. But then the sort of the next phase after that would be looking at, you know, maybe a year or two down the line, looking at fMRI scanning, you know, because we know from looking at taxi drivers who have learnt the knowledge, which is like learning every street in London, but not just the streets and their location in space, but also where the road bends, at what point,
Sort
of stuff. So, you know, these guys have massively enlarged hippocampuses. So, you know, we don't know what's going to happen long term with these people.
When is there a kind of rough date you've got where you expect to kind of publish some results, or are you just kind of...
Yeah, there's publications coming out quite soon. Again, it's super early. We're not. You know, what we find fascinating about the North Sense project is it's already out. You know, it's a wild west. You know, this is already a product. It's a non-medical product. We which is why it bypasses all the regulation. And this is a sense that, that's already available to people. And, you know, ethically, we're really profoundly both excited and concerned that this stuff is out there without the research happening first. So we think that there's a sort of social obligation to make sure those people aren't doing any damage to themselves. Much like Mark trying to wear the Oculus or equivalent headset for 28 days.
Dude, I think it's amazing that you're out there doing what you're doing, and with the focus that you've got on making this sort of bridge between the natural and the futuristic technologies, and the sort of embodied human senses and what it means to be human. And if people want to look at what you're doing, like where do you release things? Do you have a website?
Websites, it'll be ready soon. We've just rebuilt the Learning Technology Research Centre's website. I'll give you a link to my Facebook's actually a good place, because that's where I tend to sort of log all of these different technologies and the effect they're having on society. So that's another good port to actually look at. But yeah, just really to summarise, I suppose I'm really interested in the idea that we're prisoners of our own perception. You know, we never really see what we look like accurately. Other people see us as we look, but only from their own subjective state, from their own memory. You know, if we look at how we're represented in most photography, it's not accurate because of linear perspective. Mm. If you look at how you look in a mirror, you know, again, depending on the quality of the mirror, you'll get a different representation. You know, we looked at the research going into department stores where, you know, there's a different type of mirror in the shop floor to the ones in the changing room, because they want to like manipulate, you know, your buying habits. So we're sort of living in this virtual reality already. Mm. And people aren't really aware of it. You know, you don't
sleepwalked into it, though, in a way.
Yeah. You know, we don't know what we sound like because our voice box is too near to our ear box. You know, when you hear yourself on a recording, you know, you get this.
I sound like that. Yeah,
you get this sort of cognitive dissonance. So it's like, you know, we're living in a virtual reality already, but the brain is very easy to trick. So let's use the technologies that we have available to us to give us a broader sense of what reality encompasses. You know, we only experience 1% of the visual spectrum. We only experience 1% of the auditory spectrum. So how do we, you know, use technologies, whether it's like your own body technology or a plant technology or a real technology to actually expand your perception of reality?
That's the question. Mm. I'm looking forward to seeing how you answer it.
Me too.
Dude, thank you so much for your time today, Carl.
You're very welcome.
I will put all the links up that people can go and access some of your talks and things with this when it goes up. And
great.
Yeah, just really looking forward to seeing where you go with all this.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Quick shout out to Ben Chasney's Six Organs of Admittance for the intro and ending music. It's his song, The Light of the Light, which you can find on the Asleep on the Floodplain album on Drag City Records. Sixorgans.com, dragcity.com. Thank you, guys. You can see what I'm doing at Life in Fractals on Instagram, Life in Fractals on Facebook. And please tell your friends. Until the next time, be well.
We found our way. The light of the light.